Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM's about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, what's up, New York City? I'm Bernard Goyder, and you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute, live on WBAI. We're a socialist radio show and podcast from members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the U.S., with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We're run democratically by our 9,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. My name is Bernard. I use he, him pronouns. I'm a journalist and a member of the Revolutions Per Minute Production Collective. And I'm thrilled to be joined tonight by Gia Lee, an educator and organizer here in New York City. Gia, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for being here. Before we jump to the interview, we're going to listen to the headlines. Here is Amy with the Thorn headlines.
What's up, New York City? This is Amy Wilson with your headlines for today, Wednesday, August 17th. In local news, after the state Supreme Court ruled that the city council would have to reconsider the education budget, an appellate judge sided with Mayor Adams' appeal, allowing $469 million in cuts to remain for the time being. Legal challenges to the budget cuts continue and may continue into the school year. Mayor Adams' statements about Texas Governor Greg Abbott's intent to bus migrants to Washington appeared to bait Abbott into sending another bus to New York, according to a report by the city. NYCHA continues to face a budget crisis as public housing was left out of the Inflation Reduction Act. A new bill in the city council would give community land trusts and nonprofits the first priority when the city offers publicly owned land for development. Amazon is closing in on a $124 million tax break to build a warehouse in upstate New York. The funds would come from the town's school district. A victory for retired city employees who fought back against a plan to switch their benefits to a low-cost health care plan is pitting them against current employees who benefit from a fund that was set to receive the projected savings. In elections news, early voting has begun for New York's August primaries. Gotham Gazette released guides to the state Senate and congressional races. Queens Chronicle interviewed the four candidates for State Senate District 59, including DSA-endorsed Kristen Gonzalez. Soon after, Nomiki Kantz dropped out of the State Senate race in the 59th District and endorsed Gonzalez. In the past 2 weeks, a real estate-funded PAC reported spending $246,000 in support of Liz Crowley in the State Senate District 59 race. The New York Times endorsed three corporate-backed centrists in competitive congressional primaries this month. Representative Sean Patrick Maloney, who was endorsed by the Times, is receiving over $400,000 from the New York City Police Benevolent Association, which backed Donald Trump in 2020. Gothamist released a profile on the race between State Senator Gustavo Rivera, District 33 in the North Bronx, and his machine-aligned challenger, Mihalina Camilo. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez endorsed Rivera. State Senator Andrew Granardis is facing a challenge from the former council member and Bloomberg administration official David Yasky in a radically redrawn State Senate District 26 in Western Brooklyn. A pro-charter school PAC is supporting Angel Vasquez in his attempt to unseat State Senator Robert Jackson in District 31 in Upper Manhattan. Vasquez was previously the chief of staff for IDC Senator Marisol Alcantara, whom Jackson defeated in 2018 as part of a progressive wave. On Long Island, which saw major gains last year for the Republican Party, the race to replace retiring Representative Kathleen Rice, Democrat of Nassau County, is driving a wedge between State Democratic Party Chair Jay Jacobs and Rice. Before we dive back into our show this evening, we want to take a moment to mark the fifth anniversary of the Unite the Right rally and counter-protests in Charlottesville, Virginia, on August 11th and 12th, 2017. At this rally, anti-fascist counter-protester Heather Heyer was murdered by a white supremacist. And in the 5 years since her killing, many more anti-fascist and anti-racist protesters have been killed or harmed by members of the far right and actors of the state. Unfortunately, the far right continues its rise in this country and across the world, threatening the lives and livelihoods of our entire working class. Here on RPM, we often ask people what social forces or events brought them into socialism. And we've heard many times from our contributors that the events in Charlottesville in 2017 inspired them to take a more active role in organizing. Heather Heyer is more than a symbol. She was a real person who made a courageous choice and took a risk for a cause she believed in. And she should still be with us today. The impacts of Charlottesville have been far-reaching, and our comrades who counter-protested there are still living today with the physical and emotional impacts of that event. In love and solidarity with them, let's have a moment of silence for Heather and for all the victims of fascist violence, known and unknown. The struggle against fascism and the far right continues as long as there is an organized working class to conduct it. At Revolutions Per Minute, we are anti-fascist always. I'm Amy Wilson, now back to the studio for tonight's show.
Thank you, Amy. Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, a weekly newsletter by the New York City DSA Electoral Working Group that covers local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethornnyc.substack.com. And now to our show tonight. I'm thrilled to be joined by Gia, a special educator with 20 years experience teaching in public schools. Gia, you're an active member of the United Federation of Teachers, and you're involved in the MORE Caucus. Do you want to tell us a bit about the MORE Caucus and what your mission is?
Sure. And first, thank you so much for having me on your show. And, well, first of all, the Movement of Rank and File Educators Caucus formed about 11 years ago in response to, I guess, the Bloomberg era of ed privatization in New York City public schools. There was a pretty aggressive agenda to close public schools in predominantly black and brown communities. And so we formed as educators in the rank and file to lift up voices to our communities to save our schools, because we believe that public schools are absolutely necessary, and that they should be decisions should be publicly made. And so we've committed to that cause. Thank you.
Thank you, Gia. How did you get involved in teaching?
Well, I feel like I was born to be a teacher. When I was little, I play school. I don't know how many people did that, but I thought always thought it was something I really wanted to do.
You're just a nerd.
yeah. Or just like to be bossy. I don't know. But I do see the role of educators as nurturers in our school systems, in our communities. And it's just something that I believe in, that children need to be nurtured to realize who they are. And I went into the profession knowing that that was the direction. I went into college like knowing that was the direction I wanted to go into, and that I wanted to work in public schools.
Fantastic. So to give us an international perspective on education and on privatization specifically, I caught up with an old comrade of mine, Dan Stone, who is a policy officer with the National Education Union, one of the largest trade unions in the UK.
Daniel Stone. I work for the National Education Union, which is the biggest UK education union representing mostly teachers, but all other workers in schools as well, potentially. Somewhere around 500,000 members, which is one of the biggest trade unions as well in the UK. And the specific, I'm a policy officer, so I work in the policy team at the headquarters in London, and I work specifically on issues around privatisation of education. So that covers lots of different aspects of what's been happening and what happens in education policy. But obviously mainly the focus is on how private interests are taking hold in public state education in the UK. And the principal focus of that really has been a policy known as academisation, or academies, of setting up academy schools, which are akin to the US charter schools. And that has been a huge flagship policy of successive Conservative-led governments since 2010. So I work to come up with policy in relation to that. Obviously, we're opposed to it. It's a form of privatisation, but we also we campaign against it, and we also have campaigns that are directed towards particular academy school employers. I work on them and work to support our union colleagues who are campaigning for workers, for teachers.
How far would you say the UK has got in terms of academisation? It seems the Tories often are kind of these neoliberal social experimenters as a government. Point has it got to? How far has it got in that project?
Sadly, it's got very far indeed. We're talking about 70% of secondary schools, so I think that's post 11, that's 11 to 16 and possibly 18 public schools. They are now academies. They've taken on academy status, so I can say a little bit more about what that means. But in terms of primary education, which I think is elementary, I'm in the US, but that's from four or five up to 11 years old. There's a much smaller proportion. It's closer to 30% of those schools are now academies. So overall, we're still most schools in England. That's an important thing to say. This is we have a sort of devolved education system where the four nations, Northern Ireland, England, Wales and Scotland, have different education systems. But England has now a very heavily academised system. The majority of secondary schools and around a third of primary schools. Yeah, so it's really extensive, and the UK government is a pioneer in this form of neoliberal education reform. Most of this has happened since 2010 under a Conservative-led government.
Just to bring it back to like the most important thing here, what does all this mean for kids?
Academisation sort of accelerates all the negative things that we associate with neoliberal education reforms. It puts more emphasis on competition. It puts more emphasis on a kind of knowledge rich, they call it, information. The idea that kids just basically, in effect, need to memorise, need to be able to do well in tests. And it also pushes down terms and conditions for education workers. So academies don't have to follow the national terms and conditions. There's evidence that they pay less well, that the terms and conditions are worse in academies. And the knock-on effect of that is that, staff in academies are often under more pressure. They're less paid. They're less well paid. They have less autonomy. They have less control over curriculum, over pedagogy, about how they teach kids, and that's more sort of centralized, bureaucratic thing done top down, so it undermines professionalism in the workforce. And all that has a big impact on the quality of education, and also creates, because of this competitive framework, pressures to sort of remove children who are problematic in that from the system, or to at least remove them from test results. So, you know, schools in general, there's such pressure on schools to perform well in tests that you get these kind of, they call it off-rolling, and it's usually inferred from statistics rather than like something that you could actually tangibly identify. But kids that go missing, you know, kids that go missing just before exam results, so you see drops in the numbers of kids at certain schools and you wonder why that is. Well, maybe it's because they're just about to have some exams, which means if those kids sit those exams, the test results will go down for the school. So academies are part of that whole thing, which is creating a much more rigid, much less sort of rich experience for children, one that's focused on just getting through tests, not about teaching and learning that is delivered by, you know, highly professional, highly trained professionals, teachers and teaching assistants, and more just a kind of, there's a term that's been used a lot, exam factory sort of system, and academies really sort of turbocharge that, if that makes sense. But what we've had since the 1980s that set this in train, really, but markedly, you know, a sort of shift, a gear shift into a new level since 2010 when this, the mass academisation of schools became possible, is that central government, following this neoliberal agenda, just does not trust teachers, sees them as, you know, a potential kind of enemy, so to speak. You know, they think that teachers are acting in their own interests. They think they have this vision of, you know, public or, you know, bureaucrats kind of steeped in some sort of questionable left-wing ideology that they get from universities, and they want to make sure that schools in their vision are doing the best for the pupils, which means getting good test results, because that will be what will ultimately determine their success in life. So they've moved away. They've tried to reduce the agency and autonomy of teachers and of the teaching profession as a whole. The people's experience and educationalists' experience is that things are getting a lot more rigid, and that's having a hugely detrimental effect, particularly on schools that are in poorer areas, because they're the ones that obviously tend to do less well in test results, and then they get more pressure on them. So the pressure is that they need to get better results. That's felt by the teachers, that's passed on to the students. So it's the schools in poorer areas that are feeling, you know, even more pressure to conform to a particular vision of what success looks like, which is all about these tests and exam results.
What's the trade union movement's response to all this? And can you kind of take us up to where we are this summer?
One of the big challenges that the NEU faces is the, as all unions do, is the restrictions on trade union, on strike, on calling strikes effectively, which came into play in after 2016, the Trade Union Act, which introduced thresholds. So you, in order to have a national strike, you would need to get a huge percentage of your members to turn out and also to vote yes, and that they haven't, the NEU's not been able to pass that threshold for striking on any issue. So that's a big blockage
Is that because there's a kind of feeling of loyalty among teachers to their kids, that teachers really don't want to go on strike in general? They can avoid it.
My personal view is, you know, teachers, so I'm really talking about teachers here, there's a combination of factors. We have a very high density, like high union membership. Lots of teachers are members. Most teachers are members, like 90-odd% of teachers are members of a union. But the way in which that, I'd say probably their membership of a union, they consider it, more as a sort of an insurance policy, not totally in this sense, but something which they have for individual protection, maybe for issues at work, but it's not, there isn't a kind of strong militant trade unionism nationally in England or in the UK in general. So getting a sort of turnout that you'd need to get to hit those national thresholds at national level is something that's very difficult to do with the way that trade union membership is perceived, the lack of sort of militant tradition recently. So the big thing that is happening now is building for a ballot on pay. So I've just said how difficult it is to reach those national thresholds. I can't, just off the top of my head, I can't remember exactly what you need to do so, but the NEU's going to ballot this autumn, going to do a national ballot on pay, because the government's offer is around 5%, and inflation is running, depending which measure you use, but on the accurate measure, you know, 12% at the moment in the UK. So we've, teachers and education workers already suffered years, decades of real term cuts. And then this year, with inflation the way it is, they'll be suffering a huge cut to their pay. So that's what we're building towards in October.
And maybe if there's any circumstances which the Tories have managed to radicalise like a huge swathe of the British working population that works in schools, maybe this is the government that's done it kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we're in a really interesting moment, and in some ways, what's referred to as the cost of living crisis is incredibly bleak, but on the other hand, we've had we're having a series of strikes, national strikes now in rail, post, and in the rail and post industries. So, and I think, and those have been, the public have not been antagonistic towards them. They, you know, the people have understood the reasons for the strikes and they've been sympathetic. And also, there's been an opportunity for the leaders of those unions and for the unions to sort of talk about the reasons for those strikes, and it struck a chord. And so we're in a really interesting moment now where I think, yeah, there is a possibility of a yes vote on pay for education work, well, for teachers, because we're actually just balloting our teachers on pay at this point. We will be. Yeah, and that would be a huge thing to get past the threshold. And I think we'd have a lot of support this time.
That was Daniel Stone, policy officer with the National Education Union in the UK. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI, broadcasting live at 99.5 FM from New York City and streaming on your favourite podcast app. Today, we're talking about the people that help us create the society that we're going to live in the future, the people that educate our kids, teachers. We'll be taking your calls in about 10 minutes, so please do join the conversation. We're especially interested in hearing any questions tonight from teachers, parents, and even high school seniors. Probably anyone younger than that should probably be in bed by now. But it is the summer holidays, so do give us a call on 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950 if you want to join the conversation. So let's move to our next segment now. I caught up with one public school teacher, Annie Tan, who has long experience teaching in Chicago and New York charter schools and public schools, on her perspective on teachers' unions and why she's just quit the profession.
At the end of the day, they don't give a damn about our lives. And really, I have to give a damn about my life. And I just resigned a few weeks ago because I knew New York City public schools did not care about my life. And they just care about things going back to normal. So I just finished my 10th year of teaching. I taught for 4 years here in Chicago, hence me visiting to see a lot of friends. And then I taught for 6 years in New York City. All of those years I taught elementary special education, most recently fourth and fifth graders. with special needs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Great. And what subject specifically? Was it specifically special needs?
Oh, sorry. So I taught everything. I taught reading, writing, math, science, and social studies to fourth and fifth graders here.
Right. Nice. And what's your experience being a unionized teacher in Chicago, and how formative was that for your perspective on social justice?
Yeah, so I, before I even started teaching, I was an urban studies major in college with a focus on elementary education. So I had already started studying the privatization of education through policies like Race to the Top, where states literally had to compete for funding in order to, get money for their cities. And they had to follow different neoliberal privatization policies like getting charter schools, which are publicly funded, privately run schools, which are non-union in a lot of ways, a lot of places. And so I was studying that to kind of get a gauge of what I was getting myself into as a teacher. And when I graduated in 2011, unfortunately, I graduated right after the recession happened in 2008. So there were no elementary teaching jobs in New York City for me. So I decided to go through a privatization route, Teach for America, where 2/3 of the core members in Chicago were in charter schools that mostly were non-union. And in my first year here, I taught 5 grade levels of special education as a first year teacher with no special education training. And I was made to feel that it was my fault that I was a bad teacher. Whereas later I would find out that teaching a kindergartner, a first grader, 4 second graders, 2 third graders, and 2 fourth graders all in the same room was illegal, under Illinois special education law. But I didn't know that because I was in a non-union charter school that did not always follow the law. That school ended up closing in 2018 because of low test scores. And it was in that non-union charter school that I realized that I needed to fight back with my union in order to make sure our students had special education staff and services built in. And this is still an issue now in Chicago, but I got involved with the Chicago Teachers Union Special Education Committee. We fought against budget cuts in 2015 that were also illegal. We won back hundreds of jobs and stopped hundreds of jobs from being cut. And in 2018, the Special Education Committee, after I had left Chicago, and special education advocates were able to prove to the Illinois Board of Education that Chicago Public Schools was doing illegal things and not servicing tens of thousands of special education students. And there is still currently a state watchdog on Chicago Public Schools for special education now because of all of our work. So I know the power of unions here in Chicago, and I know how much they've helped. As a current person who has just resigned from teaching, I also know that there will be a shortage of teachers, and our students won't get the special education services they're entitled to because of just a lack of respect, a lack of funding in our schools, and the budget cuts that are happening across America and including in New York City are only going to exacerbate, the lack of services that exist in schools right now. So I did similar things in New York City where I was advocating for more democratic, transparent unions and trying to make sure that our union fought for the special education rights that our students needed.
That was Annie Tan from who's just quit as a teacher. Gio, how do you respond to that interview? What's your kind of perspective on that?
Well, Annie is a really good friend of mine. She works with me in the movement of rank and file educators along with hundreds of others in New York City. So I know her story really well. It's very personal to me. We're a community that tries to take care of each other. And it's been really it's been really hard and demoralizing to see some of our, you know, like strongest leaders and educators in the system who've been around for a long time and have this, you know, it takes a while for educators to develop their craft and all the love and passion that they put into their work, to see them to just, you know, to watch people just get pummeled under this very aggressive and oppressive system right now. It's a war. This feels like war. Yeah.
That's really tough to hear. So what's the movement doing to respond to that situation then? And what can we do to make the lives of teachers better in the United States?
You know, I was listening to both interviews, and I think that, you know, this idea that there's, I don't think there's a teacher shortage. I think there's a severe lack of workable and equitable conditions for us in the system. And, you know, there's, I would argue that the people behind ed privatization in our country, in the UK, and broadly, there's a trinational committee that includes Canada, the US, as well as Mexico. But I would argue this is happening everywhere. This lean production model of, you know, education that's been applied to education. The first phase of it seems to be to characterize our public school system as failing and helping that along by defunding and causing the infrastructure, the very infrastructure, to start to crumble, right? We see this in mass transit. We see this in our public hospitals. Anything that's a public good, one of the first phases seems to be to make it fail on purpose. And it's been really hard to watch this over, you know, this is, I'm going into my 23rd year of teaching. I would say what I've heard over and over and over again is educators want to have a voice. This is why we need a strong union. I can point to like Chicago and Los Angeles, even West Virginia, when educators realize that we actually have nothing to fear, but to use our labor as a wedge to call for the conditions that are, you know, our students deserve in their learning, and that educators and all people who work in schools get what we need. And it's not unreasonable. These are not unreasonable things. These are, we have a really a big problem of a scarcity mindset under that system of competition. So yeah, I think that number one, having a voice in democratic systems are severely lacking. We could tell you everything that we need for our students and our working conditions, and we're not given the opportunity to be part of making these decisions.
Thank you, Gia. One of the things that Annie mentioned later on the call that we didn't have time to wear was just the fact that when you get budget cuts, it seems that language programs and arts, music are the things that get cut, and there's just this relentless focus on tested subjects. And that really does seem to impact poorer communities hardest, doesn't it?
Yeah. So one of the first ways in which I got involved too in this is through the opt-out movement, and that if you follow the money, right? And there's been tons of research at the federal level, at the Federal Board of Education, and every district across the country that points to and including psychometricians, people who actually design standardized tests, who've all said, you know, actually standardized tests are a poor tool, poor element to determine whether or not schools are effective or not. One thing they point to are conditions outside of the school building that actually have a greater impact. However, under the system of accountability, which I would argue is not just a right-wing thing, we've seen this championed by Democrats as well, such as Obama, not like with Race to the Top. And legislation at pretty much every state and local level that's championed by Democrats around accountability metrics. They often ask, so how else are we going to be able to measure whether or not schools are doing well? And you follow the money, and sure enough, you find hedge funds and charter PACs behind this rhetoric, this false rhetoric. So there's this incredible move to focus on these metrics to decide whether or not schools are doing what they're meant to do. And the effect of that is the elimination of all of the programs that make schools places that students want to go.
So why is capital so in favor of standardized testing and so in favor of kind of removing a lot of the more interesting, the more fun aspects of education?
One thing that these tests do, and this was early on, I would say about 2005 is when I really got involved in opt-out and as a conscientious objector refusing to administer state tests, is that they would use these test scores to determine whether or not schools were quote-unquote failing. And they would get put on a list. In New York, you get put on a list that is, you know, they come up with different names for it, but would ultimately result in schools in danger of closure. And once these schools close, the buildings become occupied by charter schools eventually. In District 16, which is Bed-Stuy and going towards East New York, there are now more charter schools than there are public schools. So to that end, I would say that those mechanisms, it's become a tool towards privatization.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI 99.5. I'm Bernard Goyder, and I'm thrilled to be joined by Gia Lee, a teacher at a public elementary school in Alphabet City. We've got around 20 minutes left of the show, so I think it's time to open the phone lines once again. So if you do want to get involved, please do give us a call. We're on 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. So let's talk a little bit about the current situation in New York, because we've had this quite strange funding row in the city council that I think illuminates a number of things about the Adams administration. It would be great to get your perspective on it. For people that haven't followed, there was a vote on a budget for the council that was passed with an overwhelming majority. That pushed through quite pretty significant budget cuts. Gia, do you want to pick up the story?
Sure. I'll tell it like a story too. So on June 13th, the city council was pretty much rushed by the speaker and the mayor to pass an education budget. Overwhelmingly, it was passed. There were six city council members who voted no. And there is a state law that says that all budget considerations have to go through the public body, which is the Panel for Educational Policy, the PEP, which is comprised of panel members that about mayoral appointees, and then there are five that are appointed by borough presidents with one parent elected member. There's only one elected member. Now, this is where the public, parents, students, educators, concerned citizens can go on and speak openly. It's a public forum. The city bypassed that process, this legal process. And how they did that was the Chancellor David Banks issued an emergency, situation to bypass that process. So there's currently a lawsuit. There was a lawsuit that was heard on August 4th. The judge determined that the budget was passed illegally, that the mayor's budget was illegal, and pretty much created a stay on the budget cuts, about $469 million. from that point, I mean, we had a huge rally outside. Several elected officials were with us, parents, students, educators spoke out, and we were thrilled when the judge called this, Judge Frank. But then the mayor sued and appealed to overturn it, citing that the budget needed to get past because school was starting, which we couldn't understand why the mayor of the city would sue to have the budget cuts. Fast forward to now, we are hearing that the mayor actually got the appeal. Whatever judge saw, heard this part, did say that until August 29th, he would return the mayor's budget cut, but it had to be heard on August 29th. So the city council is finally, this is what we hear, in negotiations with the mayor's office. So we're very busy right now, speaking with our elected officials, our city council members, to see where they're at in terms of what strategies they're using. And that's one part of where we're at.
Yeah, let's jump to our first call. Caller, you're on WBAI 99.5 live. What's your name?
Hi, my name's Martina, and I'm a teacher in New York City as well.
Hi, thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, and thanks so much for having Gia on. I really admire her work in organizing for so long.
Hey, Martina. Yeah,
hey, what's up, Gia? I was wondering if you could talk more specifically about the privatization efforts in New York, sort of the players that are coming into the fore again, because I know you have a lot of institutional knowledge to share, and I think it's important for folks to see the patterns over time. You know, we want all of our listeners and all of New Yorkers to have a long memory and to recognize, you know, following the money, what's really going on.
Sure, I could definitely answer that question.
Go for it.
I hear a little bit of an echo, so that's why I hesitate. So thank you, Martina, who's a wonderful organizer and activist. I remember back when Bloomberg was mayor, he had key people from the New Teacher Network and the key people from Students First New York, which are both entities that were originated by Michelle Rhee. And if you don't know who Michelle Rhee is, please Google. When Mayor Adams came in, he brought in the very same people, including Dan Weisberg, who is the deputy chancellor, and who we hear is actually the one who makes all the decisions. He's currently the director of the New Teacher Project in New York and sits on the board of directors for the Educators for Excellence. These are all Gates funded, also funded by both right wing and left wing ed privatizers. People we need to look out for. They're very aggressive behind closed doors. One example I will quickly give is when our administrators heard and got their budgets in June, they based it on enrollment projections that were incorrect. They basically use a formula that looks at any drop in enrollment or rise in enrollment and do a 3-year average and apply it right to the coming year. They applied really large drops that happened in COVID despite administrators reporting that their enrollments were actually much higher. They were rejecting any appeals. So this was done until parents and educators and administrators started to call it out. So, but these are the people making decisions right now.
Cool. Do you want to add anything else?
No, just I think it's important to recognize that we must speak truth to power and that there's power in numbers, and there is so much effort made to drive a wedge between parents and educators, but we actually want the same thing, which is a sound education for all of our students and justice.
Amen to that. Thank you. Thank you very much. So, yeah, Jay, in terms of the, in terms of kind of the, one of the things I noticed was that the comptroller of New York City, Brad Lander, identified $800 million in excess revenues from like COVID federal funding and DOE funding and all this kind of stuff. Like the money seems to be there. So is there more of like an ideological mission to kind of discipline the public school system by imposing cuts? And especially given the fact that the mayor's office seems to have be obsessed by just kind of adding more to the massive NYPD budget rather than doing anything about schools.
Yeah, so not only is there about $5 billion in federal COVID relief funding that's supposed to go towards our schools, I was at Senator John Liu's education town hall in Flushing, Queens, and he pointed out he wanted to lift up the fact that the state sends funds to the city for education. What the city then does is put it into per pupil spending, right? So the budget formula for New York City public schools changed during mayoral control. And so that each student gets a certain allocation amount. And then basically there's percentages or weights applied if a student has an IEP, that's, you know, if they have special education services, or if they're English as a second language learner, you know, all these other things. But we found out during this whole process that not only did they cut the budget, they also lowered the per pupil rate by $25 per student. Yet there's no public accounting or report of the $5 billion in federal COVID relief money that was supposed to go to the schools, or the state funding money there's about $800 million unaccounted for.
Yeah. So in terms of what that means, then it means this is just a kind of mission by the mayor's office to screw up schools, and potentially to open the way for more charters.
Absolutely. We were at the last panel. Many of us were at the last panel for educational policy meeting last week. It was, I think it was on Thursday. And it's also the place where the panel, the PEP, votes on city contracts for the DOE. And on there was a very, very sizable contract for charter schools that were taking enrollments for pre-K. That was a very contentious item for the panel members. Of course, the mayoral appointees who dominate in numbers on the panel voted for. Everyone else pretty much was voting against. So we know if there was these millions of dollars for that, why didn't it go to supporting the public schools that were offering pre-K, for example? But there's just zero accountability with the mayor's office.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5. We've still got a bit of time for calls. If you do want to, if you are an educator or you're a parent, please do give us a call on 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. And also, we rely on audience donations to make this radio show happen, to pay our wonderful engineering team and to keep the lights on. So please, if you'd like to donate, you can do so at 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. Jill, is there anything else you want to add around the kind of state of education in New York City at the moment, and indeed the kind of solidarity that you see in the labor movement?
Yeah. One thing I really want to point out and lift up is that this scarcity mindset, the idea that there's such a limited amount of funds, has created great division in New York City. And I know folks are aware, but we're the largest school district in not just the state, but across the nation. You know, Brooklyn could be like the size of Los Angeles, for example. So organizing is really hard. But then we also have communities that feel like they have to fight for scraps. So there's this argument that some parents are making that we can't lower class sizes, for example, because we want to have, you know, after school programs or arts or things like that. And instead, we really need to not feed into that debate and rather help come around to a common understanding about the roots of this scarcity, this austerity budget, to fight for everything that our kids need. And if there's elected officials who can't see that and are too tied to their own interests or their, you know, whoever's funding their campaigns, then we need to get rid of them. Our union leadership has not gone far enough, and that's where more comes in.
So what do you think, to excuse a pun, what more do you think the union leadership could be doing at the moment in terms of standing up for its members?
Our union leadership comes from a history of business unionism, bureaucratic unionism. So they depend on tactics that rely on negotiating, you know, behind closed doors. And often what they are, well, right now, actually, they're currently telling members to lower expectations for our current contract that's coming up. And I think they're fearful of these budget cuts instead of being part of the fight. Parents are leading the way and they're slowly coming out here and there, but their talking points, even on their flyers, are just about the funding formula. They don't go far enough in organizing the largest union to wage some kind of job action if necessary to stop these cuts. We should be demanding to have full funding or to go on strike.
And is there any move by the union leadership to ballot for strikes?
None. There's been no talk of that. In fact, I've only heard that there are deep negotiations with the mayor's office for upcoming contract and that it's actually going nowhere, which is really disappointing.
It's smoke-filled rooms rather than union democracy in terms of how it works, which is really sad. So you're listening to Revolutions Per Minute with me, Bernard Goyder. Today we've been talking about education and New York public schools in particular and some of the cuts that have been happening. It's been, really great, Jia, getting your perspective on the public school system. In terms of what's happening next in terms of the movement then, is there anything you'd like to flag in particular in terms of what upcoming events or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Thank you for that. And there's a gathering at the Bohemian Beer Hall in Queens on Thursday from 5 to 7. We would love to have fellow rank-and-file folks out there. I know you're listening, because we are going to talk about how we're going to organize our base grassroots to across sectors. We need educators out who are interested in organizing at the school level and building power at the school level and then across our districts and across the city. And look out for more Caucus NYC on social media and our website.
Excellent. You've been listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 and streaming on your favorite podcast app. To connect with us after the show, you can email us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, Twitter at NYCRPM. Thanks again for listening. And I hope everyone's been able to educate themselves on some of these issues as a result of our show. I certainly have learned a huge amount speaking to Jia, and Annie and Daniel as well in the UK. And yeah, it's just been great. So thank you all so much. And until next time, solidarity.